Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
Produced by the iLab at WBUR, Boston.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. In the most difficult moments we face, we lean on our partners, rely on them, and take turns being the stronger one. Peter Goodman learned that firsthand, as he writes about in his essay, Superheroes Just for Each Other. His essay is read by Mike Coulter. He's the star of Luke Cage on Netflix, and you can also see him in The Defenders, Jessica Jones, and The Good Wife.
The first time I lifted her up and carried her away, I was acting on a whim, seeking an exit from a stupid but dangerous argument. Though we lived in the glittering center of Shanghai, we couldn't agree on where to go for dinner. Chinese or Italian? A high-rise restaurant with a commanding view, or the leafy garden of a French colonial mansion? The stakes were hardly critical, yet our conflict was a proxy for a deeper question gnawing at our life as a couple. Where were we headed? I grew exasperated. She said, "Forget dinner." In previous relationships, I might have stormed out and sought diversion in a bar, writing off the possibility of resolution as both futile and beneath my pride. This time, though, I swept up Deanna in my arms, damsel in distress style. Caught by surprise, she succumbed to my rescue. I had literally elevated us above our stalemate. We kissed and headed out to dinner, no longer concerned about where we went. As a product of a 1970s-style parenting that embraced therapy, I had been marinated in the notion that talk was the sole means of alleviating human friction. Deanna and I did plenty of talking. We could stay up all night and not run out of things to say. But the obstacles in our relationship were sufficiently weighty that words alone would not resolve them. I'm a dozen years older and was keen to start a family. But she wasn't ready. I was an expat living in China, a foreign correspondent seeking to extend that life indefinitely. She was longing to get back to her family in New York, and appalled by the thought of letting my career dictate her geography. She would be no one's appendage. Talk can yield clarity, understanding, and empathy, but sometimes it just brings exhaustion and recrimination. Sometimes action is the only pathway to goodwill, and when I picked her up, I proved it. When we met, Deanna was about to move back to New York, but she didn't know where she would live or how she would support herself as she finished her first novel. I persuaded her to move in with me and stay in Shanghai. When she expressed discomfort with my high-rise apartment, my bachelor pad, where the security guards eyed her suspiciously, I found us another home. I felt a compulsion to surprise her, ease her worries, protect her, and demonstrate my devotion. I was intent on proving my worth to her. For the first time in my adult life, I had fallen so hard for a woman that she altered my values and updated my ways of thinking, as if the world itself was new, all of which made me addicted to her approval. She still doubted that we had a future. Even as each month seemed to reinforce the reality that we were hooked in deep. Now, I had this go-to move. Every time she felt lost or worried, I swept her off her feet. Every time she contemplated walking away, I carried her over the next threshold. I aspired to be her superhero, rescuing her from whatever perils lay in our path. 2 years into our relationship, I moved us back to New York. I threw myself into eradicating the mice from our Brooklyn apartment. I attacked the weeds in our modest backyard, wielding screwdrivers and pliers to keep the house in working order, and navigated pushy elbows at the farmer's market. At our wedding, on a steamy August evening underneath the Manhattan Bridge, I provoked gasps of delight from our friends and family as I carried my bride across the pebble beach and deposited her on the makeshift podium where we pronounced our vows. Unimpeachable evidence that I had not only captured her, but earned her. When our son was born, I found myself, perhaps like most new fathers, feeling marginalized. But I could still wake up in the middle of the night and administer a bottle of pumped milk while Deanna slept. I could assemble strollers, change diapers, and wrestle with car seats. But the next year, when our daughter arrived, my powers failed me. I was standing at the gate at LaGuardia Airport, about to board an early flight to Chicago for a reporting trip, when my phone rang. Deanna was in excruciating pain, home alone with our 13-month-old boy. She used the word contractions. But how could that be? It was early October. Our baby girl wasn't due until mid-January. Only 2 weeks earlier, we had gone in for the anatomy scan, and everything was perfect. "Let's wait 10 minutes, I told her, thinking the scare would surely pass. But 10 minutes later, I was sprinting out of the airport to a taxi line. When my cab got a flat on the highway and the driver shrugged, refusing to proceed, I heard myself threatening bodily harm as I forced him to continue to the next exit. There, I managed to commandeer another cab and arrived at the hospital to find my wife doubled over in pain, unsure where she was supposed to go. I braced her with my arms and led her into the delivery ward. But I was powerless to protect her from what came next. I held her hand while the doctors listened for the baby's heartbeat. I hunched by her side during the emergency C-section. We listened to the muffled sounds of the surgeons exchanging words about a subject we could not comprehend. Was this a stillbirth? A miscarriage? What we learned provided neither clarity nor comfort. Our baby weighed less than 2 pounds. She had a 1/3 chance of dying and a 1/3 chance of surviving with severe developmental disabilities. As Deanna lay in a recovery room bed, I was led upstairs to the neonatal intensive care unit, where this wisp of a creature was encased in a glass incubator and connected to an alarming tangle of tubes, wires, and beeping machinery. It did not feel right to look at her, let alone photograph her, as the nurses urged me to do so I could share this image with Deanna. She didn't look like a baby to me. There was nothing I could say or do to lift us from our stark reality. I tried to reassure Deanna that there was at least a 1/3 chance that our daughter would be fine. But then the doctor returned to our hospital room to tell us that our daughter had suffered a brain hemorrhage. She used the word catastrophic and discussed the possibility of comfort care, a euphemism for pulling the plug. If the hemorrhage proved to be severe enough, we might have the option of detaching her from the machinery. Within an hour, she would die. I heard this as my cue to rescue my wife from my worst fears. Once the doctor had left, I told Deanna that if comfort care became our daughter's fate, We would not be there to watch her die. We would go home to our irrepressible boy and pretend none of this happened. We would tell ourselves this was a miscarriage, never having known her. We would not know the pain of losing her. I felt strengthened by my words of resolve. But my wife looked at me as if I had become a stranger, as if she were now facing this crisis alone. "If it comes to that," she said, "we would be there. We're her parents. However long she lives, whatever her life turns out to be, we're the ones who have to hold her. She's our baby." In that moment, I recognized that my wife was the real superhero. In trying to plot a clean escape, I was the coward. Over the months that followed, as our girl endured transfusions, a collapsed lung, and countless terrifying procedures, fighting her way to a miraculous recovery and growing into the indomitable toddler she is today, my wife and I took turns rescuing each other. When one faltered, the other extended a hand. These days, we take deep pleasure in the simplest moments. We feel our daughter's sweet breath as we hold her and watch her splash her brother in the bathtub, and we feel blessed. We know how close we came to losing her and to losing ourselves. I am no superhero, neither is my wife, but we have a bond that somehow enables us to save each other from basic human weakness. This is its own kind of superpower.
Mike Coulter, reading Peter Goodman's essay, Superheroes Just for Each Other. We'll catch up with Peter after the break.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments, ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. Finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
Peter Goodman says what he remembers most about his daughter's birth is the trauma of not knowing what was happening.
It certainly felt like the termination of a pregnancy as opposed to the beginning of a life. I mean, I vividly remember the nurse bringing me up to the neonatal intensive care unit and saying, "Here's your baby. And why don't you take a picture of your baby so you can show your wife," as if this were a birth with congratulations all around. And of course, this felt not only confusing, but catastrophic. I mean, here is this tiny creature. And of course, the pain of this, as I tell you this, is that now I look at the picture that I took that morning, and that's my daughter.
Peter and his wife Deanna were never sure that their daughter Mila was going to be all right. But the longer she lived, the better her odds became.
We would be woken up in the middle of the night by these terrifying calls from the doctors on call, telling us things that we couldn't even entirely understand. And yet, I vividly remember sitting there, putting my hands into the side of the incubator and her grasping my finger for the first time. And then there was a nurse who picked her up and swaddled her. She was so tiny, she was so light, but for the first time I held her in my arms. And that was very, very powerful.
After Mila had been home for a year, the family started to regain a sense of normalcy. But suddenly, Mila was unexpectedly put into the national spotlight. Some background here. Peter was an editor at the Huffington Post then, which was owned by AOL. One day, he learned that Tim Armstrong, the CEO of AOL, had said he was cutting retirement benefits for the whole company because of rising healthcare costs, specifically because two AOL employees had distressed babies whose medical care had cost the company $1 million each.
People in the newsroom began to quietly come into my office. Like, he's talking about your kid. He's blaming your kid for high healthcare costs.
Peter didn't feel he could say much while he was working for the Huffington Post, but his wife Deanna wrote a piece in Slate about what it felt like to have her daughter's existence, as she wrote, quote, used as a scapegoat for cutting corporate benefits. The piece got a huge response.
One of the great things about Deanna going public with this was that it put us in touch with, you know, a whole community of people whose medical conditions had been reduced to a burden on society. And it gave us a sense that we were part of a big community of people whose everyday problems had somehow been reduced to, you know, this thing that we had to apologize for. And to understand that there was a broad societal context that involved a lot of people, you know, far beyond us was a very empowering thing.
Tim Armstrong eventually apologized for the statement. That was 4 years ago. Mila's five now, and she's totally healthy. According to her dad, she's a fierce, determined little girl. She loves reading, drawing, and even rock climbing, something her parents could have never imagined in those early days.
Every milestone with Mila was profound and special in a whole different way because, of course, we had grappled with the fear that she wouldn't be able to do these things. We didn't know if she'd be able to walk. We didn't know if she'd have full function of her hands. It was just about a week ago that for the first time I got Mila to bicycle without training wheels. And that's an exhilarating experience for any parent, but it was especially exciting with Mila. And each of these milestones does give us a sense that she's in control of her destiny. I mean, she can have whatever life she chooses to have for herself.
That's Peter Goodman. He's the European economics correspondent for the New York Times, and he lives in London with his family. More in a minute.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments, ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. Finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
Mike Coulter says that this essay made him think about all the things that parents can't protect their children from.
As a father, you are sort of powerless, and it's something that I don't care how strong of a man you are, it really hits home for me and being a parent. So I think this is a piece that lots of people will connect with, and it has a happy ending. So this is one that we can hold on to and cherish and say, well, sometimes life is fair.
Thanks again to Mike for reading this week's essay. You can see him in season 2 of Luke Cage on Netflix. And here's Daniel Jones, editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times.
I'm always intrigued with how men construct their masculinity within a relationship. And in Peter's case, he feels like he needs to be decisive and he needs to be strong. And when they hit this crisis with their child who's born prematurely, it was this challenging moment in their relationship and challenging to his ideas of his role in their marriage and how that sort of related to manhood and sort of deconstructing that manhood. I just thought he did a great job of teasing those things out.
Next week, Diane Guerrero from Orange is the New Black and Jane the Virgin.
I thought about the other Laura walking around in Mexico, spending my money, and even speaking to officials at my bank, all in an apparently convincing performance of me. And here I was, the real me, unable to tell in ways that ostensibly mattered. A convincing story about who I was. It made me wonder for a moment if maybe she was actually a better candidate for being me than I was.
Modern Love is a production of the New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, Caitlin O'Keefe, John Perotti, and Amory Sievertson. Sound design and original scoring by Matt Reed. Our intern is Louisa Judge. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.